Hey, this afternoon it is my great pleasure to introduce two friends of mine, one a long, long, long time friend and one sort of newer friend. Both of them have had a big impact on my life because they have tilted the window through which I look at the world. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to make this introduction. Several years ago I walked into this very conference and we were going to a session on history. My son is a history buff. And in came this woman in what looked like a nun's habit. And it was very strange, and she started talking about some very strange things, and I could almost feel my brain wiggling in its case. And it was Sandra Dodd, who has, in the ensuing years, continued to rattle my cage and shake up the way I look at things. And I know you'll enjoy her and her perspective a great deal. And the other is Richard Prostowski, a dear friend of many years, friend of the family, mentor to my children, and the editor of Paths of Learning magazine, college dean, and just a very interesting, warm, wonderful man. I am sure that you will all benefit from their presentation this afternoon, and it is my great pleasure to introduce Richard Prostowski and Sandra Dodd.
It was already on there. Is it on now? I want to start by reading. I always try to avoid reading, but I have to say something that I said 5 years ago, and I'd rather just do that because I wrote it when it was new. Someone online, where I seem to live, to some of you, I suppose, posted one day, "I get very impatient with my kids, and then I yell or make them do what I want. How do you all stay so patient?" And I wrote, "Other moms have told me they think I'm patient. It makes me feel guilty because I have the internal list of all the times I've blown it, but a few things have helped me. The biggest was Adult Children of Alcoholics, an Al-Anon group. I went to meetings for 4 years and learned a lot of calming and encouraging things. One of those is to remember what I wanted and needed as a child. Then I try to give those things to my children. I don't mean toys or books. I mean listening and smiling and joking and letting them climb on stuff even if it made me nervous. And not making such strictly-to-the-minute rules like be back at 5:45 or else. Another arbitrary control junk. One of the quotes or sayings from that learning time is, how important is it? And thinking that little mantra can help a ton all by itself. If we waste our energy and our relationship with our children on how they wear their socks and where they keep their toothbrush between times, there's nothing left for important things. I try to save it for important things, and I try not to be the defining judge of what's important. There are things the kids consider very important, and I force myself at first until I calm myself down and remember to give, to pay attention to their stuff too. No, that's nice, dear, while I ignore them. When it happens occasionally that I've done that, I feel bad, and I sometimes go back and say, tell me again about that game, I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. My next biggest influence was La Leche League. Did I say that? This is 5 years ago, so my kids were five and up. Okay. There I learned that children have within them what they need to know, and that the parent and child are a team, not adversaries. It reinforced the idea that if you are loving and gentle and patient, that children want to do what you ask them to do, and that they will come to weaning, potty training, separation from mom, and all those milestones without stress and without fear if you don't scare them or stress them. Seems kind of obvious, but our culture has 1,000 roadblocks. From having studied meditation and Eastern religion, I learned the value of breathing. I think that in Western terms, what it does is dissipate adrenaline. I remember in the 1960s and early 70s, it was big news that yogis could actually slow their heartbeats at will. Well, duh, wrote I. People had been doing it in church, those who cared to actually be still and know, for hundreds of years. But nobody thought to wire up contemplative Christians. When people, parents or kids, are agitated and they're thinking for a moment that something has to be just this way and right now, breathing helps. Deep breathing, slow, and full as possible exhalation. This is also, in Western terms, count to 10. Calm down and let the adrenaline go. Some people have biochemistry that's not easy to control, and some people just count too fast. And that the woman's question continued, I ride my kids a lot, I give them absolutes a lot, and I know they're not happy with this. And I wrote, if you aren't willing to make radical changes, that will get worse before it gets better. Even if it seems to calm down, I'm afraid it would be because your kids gave up wanting and thinking and wishing. The last part of it, she wrote, win-win solutions in our house are not the majority. And I wrote, at ours they have been, and I think it's the La Leche League influence and the fact that I wanted consciously not to raise my kids the way I was raised. And I looked for peaceful and warm solutions to what the tapes in my head said should be my way and the right way, and I shushed those tapes. This all made it easier to disconnect the school teacher tapes when that time came. Other tools than breathing and memory and desire that I use are humor, touch, and smell. Hold your kid and smell the hair so you remember who this is you're treating like an object if you're getting frenzied. And music. Sometimes music, often on a video, will change the air and the mood. Have some upbeat stuff in mind for such occasions. If possible, when things get raspy, go out to lunch, or to a new and different grocery store, or buy something you've never bought. Yesterday, 5 years ago, I found some new Keebler peanut butter sticks, like crackers or cookie things, and the kids liked them and they were cheap. Just something like that, something that seems trivial, can give you the 3-minute reprieve you need to think clearly. Be present. I'm aware of needing to be at a wedding today and where and when I need to deliver and pick up kids and that we're having overnight guests. And Marty has hockey orientation tomorrow and Kirby's spending the day with his friend. It's a very busy schedule, but as each child wakes up, he or she needs that moment, not my mutterings about later or tomorrow. One moment spent asking how they slept and if they're ready to eat and hearing a dream will change the rest of that day for both of us. I hide toys. I rotate cool building sets and games, so when there's a tense day and people are jittery, something can be pulled out. I rent videos that will give them time to sit and be calm and also hear music or learn about people and places they didn't know about before. I work with them. Instead of making Holly, who is 5, clean her room, I help her. We talk. I get to help her figure out good storage plans and sorting plans for doll clothes and cards and her hat collection and her shoes. And to sort the clean clothes she dropped on the floor from those she actually did wear all day. And we've been together in a real way and visited and accomplished and learned. That's not all, but that's a lot. In the 5 years since then, I haven't slid backwards. I'm not sure I've made huge strides. But at my house, that's what I do. We're going to talk some more about what peace can look like. In the program or in the syllabus, we're mixed up about what's where, pretty much. It said, a good relationship between children and parents makes learning together easier and more joyful. So we wanted you to think about these questions while we're talking, and then if there are 3x5 cards out, please save the questions until we're done, because it seems to keep happening this weekend that the questions are about what we're about to talk about. So wait a little bit, and then write questions, and there are helpers who just pass them toward the front or to the ends of the aisle, and I think they'll make it up here. I believe we will have time for questions. How can a good relationship with a toddler be maintained through the teen years? If a family starts homeschooling later, what will help heal a rough start? And what principles guide your family decisions? Because there are two of us, we will repeat ourselves, but so will your children and so will you. So now it's Richard's turn.
Testing, is this on?
Cute.
Right? Ooh. I threw rolls or something. When Sandra and I were coming up with the idea for this workshop and talking about it, we weren't sure exactly how to define what it is we're talking about. That was sort of one of the things we're kicking around, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But one of the things that I find really powerful and important in Sandra's work, and one of the reasons I was glad that she would read what she read to you at the beginning, is that she laid out a lot of concrete practices. And I think that one of the things that happens when we get into notions like peaceful parenting or parenting for peace or however you want to put it, I'm reminded of the old Zen story of, the person who is pointing to the moon, or there's the finger pointing to the moon, and the lesson is don't get caught up in the finger pointing to the moon. It's the moon you're supposed to be looking at. And that language is like the finger pointing to the moon. And as even though I'm an English major and I love language, I love to play around with language, that the key really is not to get so caught up in what does peaceful parenting mean and define it in intellectual terms. which is okay to do. That's really focusing on the finger pointing to the moon. The key is to engage in the actual practice. There's a common understanding in Eastern thinking that the path and the goal are the same. And it's not only Eastern thinking, it's just very prevalent in Eastern philosophy and religion that concept comes up. We often don't keep that in mind, that if we have a goal to achieve peaceful parenting, however we end up defining that, and again, we will get to a little exercise later where we'll try messing around with that. But if that's our goal, the question is, well, how do you get there? Well, you get to peaceful parenting by parenting in peace. You get to peaceful parenting through peaceful parenting. In other words, peace is the road. There is no other way to peace. There is no other time other than the meantime. I will be with my kids more when I have time later. In the meantime, I have to do X, Y, and Z. But there is no time other than the meantime. The only time you can be alive is right now. The only time you can practice peaceful parenting or parenting with peace is right now. And so the question becomes then how do you do that? which is the topic of sort of the rest of this talk. One of the things I want to stress just at the early phase at this point is that it's not that if you are engaged in peaceful parenting practice that you won't run into problems. You can't live and not run into problems, right? It doesn't mean that all you have to deal with are problems, right? But doing this kind of practice does not mean you're not going to have the problems. It means that you have tried to figure out a better way to deal with the problems. And the story I'd like to tell just for a second here is a story that someone told at a retreat I went to a few years ago. This guy and I had been on a couple of Buddhist retreats together. I've since lost touch with him. I always found he was a young man, relatively young man, but he had wonderful insight for somebody who was chronologically so young. And the teacher asked us a question as we started out. She said, how's your practice going, you know, and how do you know how you're doing and so forth, just as a kind of way to let us kind of pass the talking stick around and talk. Here's what the guy said. He said, you know, when I'm not in my practice, when I'm really out of practice, right, in other words, I'm not mindfully there more often than not, okay? What happens is I say something to somebody that is really off base, and then a little while later I realize I shouldn't have said that, and then I go and apologize. He said, when I'm more in practice, I say something to somebody that's a little off base, and I immediately realize I shouldn't have said it, and then I go and apologize. He said, and when I'm really, really in practice, right before I'm about to say something that's off base, I catch myself and I don't say it, so I don't have to apologize. I thought, that's fantastic. Because what is he saying? He's saying the practice, right? Which is to say, in this case, your spiritual practice, your parenting practice, right? The path that you're on. It doesn't mean you won't have these difficulties and problems that you're going to have to deal with. It means that you're more mindful about them, and you're probably in a better position, at least sometimes, to catch them before they occur and then not have to apologize later. So that's my part of the intro, is to keep in the background, the path and the goal are exactly the same. You get there through the path. You get to the goal by getting to the goal. There's no other way.
I want you to also be thinking about what is not peaceful. And we're not talking about absence of war at your house. You know, it would be really terrible if there was a war right here and everybody was having to, you know, get in the old bomb shelters. I'm not talking about that kind of peace. I'm talking about the peace of the moment, the peace of each child's soul. So what is not peace? Imagine or remember what made you as a child ever feel alone or separate or unsafe, and provide the opposite of those things. Visualize the greatest distance between a child and a parent, either from your own experience or from families you know that you remind yourself not to become like, or, you know, families in literature. Any family you can picture that seems like they don't have peace, look at what they have and don't have that. As the sculptors say, you know, it's kind of a joke about sculpture, is just chip away anything that doesn't look like peace. And that's, it seems small, it seems trite, but that's it, that's the whole thing. A loud, happy home is more peaceful than a home where people are afraid to disturb the peace. So there are a lot of synonyms for peace, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, but if you just see it as quiet, that's not going to be necessarily peaceful. You could be so terrified that you will just be quiet. But you can also be happy, yelling, running around, and feel totally, totally safe and at peace.
When we were pairing, and we got to this point, one of the things that I chipped in on, my ideas that I wanted to share with you is, you know, I go back to Dr. King's work a lot, because he was a very good teacher on this. And, you know, one of the things he was accused of, today it's hard for especially younger people to realize that Dr. King had a lot of enemies. You know, people didn't like what he was doing. He was out there to really shake things up and change society in a way that was pretty radical. You know, he got assassinated. I mean, you know, and it wasn't because he was just out there, you know, la-di-da-ding around. And one of the things that he was accused of, he and his followers, is that they were creating an awful lot of tension by the boycotts and the protests and so on. Somebody's got a cell phone. Is that yours?
That's okay.
Yeah, it's like the let's make a deal. I'll give you $50 for a cell phone in your purse. All right, never mind. Old TV show. Anyway, he was accused of creating a lot of tension. And King went on to say that the presence of justice does not necessarily mean the absence of tension. And that, in fact, when you're pursuing a course towards justice, very often tension will rise to the surface. And so one of the things that we learned from Dr. King is that in the practice of trying to achieve justice, or in this case, a practice of peace in the parenting, there will be things that will rise to the surface. As Sandra says, it's not that it's going to be calm and quiet and tranquil and that sort of thing. You'll have moments like that. And in fact, you should create moments like that. You should make sure that you get some walking meditation in, that you get some time to just breathe and so forth. But there will be things that will come to the surface. And so the question is, how do you deal with them? Not will you have to deal with them. The answer is yes, you will have to deal with them. But the question is, how do you deal with them? And one of the things I have found in teaching seminars on nonviolence is that there is a widespread misconception people have about nonviolence. That nonviolence is a kind of passive, and forgive me for putting it this way, like a passive mamby-pamby, roll over, let them walk all over you. You know, they assassinate the peacemakers. Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated not when he was a warrior, but when he became a peacemaker. And he was assassinated by someone in Israel precisely because of his involvement in the peace process. Gandhi was assassinated. Dr. King was assassinated. The peacemakers scare the heck out of people. This is very, very difficult work. I think it's on a short-sighted and short-term level easier to engage in practices of violence. It's harder in the long term because you take on karma that's going to be tougher to get rid of. But in the long run, it's really much, much more difficult to go that route. And the practice of peace and peaceful parenting is not a road that's necessarily just calm and quiet, as Sandra says. There's going to be stuff that's going to rise to the surface. The question is, how are you dealing with that? And that leads into our...
We're going to make a list in a minute, but I have a couple of stories to tell you first. One is a thing that teachers all learn. One of the basic things that all the teachers learn is Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and I think it's a real legitimate and important thing to know. And one of the things that Abraham Maslow is a researcher and a theorist, and he said that before anyone can learn, before you can come to the point in your life, and this either fluctuates by, you know, by the day, by the week, by stages of growth, you need to feel safe. You need to have food, you need to have shelter, you need to have love. This has been used in part to remind teachers to be nice and in part to apply for federal funding. You know, the government pays for breakfast because Maslow convinced a bunch of people that they can't learn if they're hungry. A lot of, they made laws that said teachers have to report abuse because Maslow convinced them that no one can learn if they don't feel secure and loved and safe. But in this case, I think homeschoolers need to realize that if a child is always unsettled and never feeling calm, you know, if they always feel kind of like they're on one foot, they won't learn nearly as well as if they feel like they actually live in that house safely and go to sleep without worrying. And so when we get to the list, think about those kind of things. That's the kind of peace I'm talking about. Because I'll confess right now, you know, my husband's a contractor, or he's an engineer for Honeywell and does contract work for National, United Defense. So it's not, I'm not the good and moral peacenik that Richard is. And Richard's a good Buddhist and I'm just a goof. But, I'm not talking about international peacemaking efforts, because at that I'm a slouch. I'm talking about a child's moment-to-moment life. One story I want to tell is the current danger at my house. Started about 3 years ago. I have two teenagers. At the moment, they're 13 and 16. They keep getting older, so I have to keep remembering how old they are. And we got a bigger house, so our house is really the hangout for teenagers very, very often. There are two or three extras. Sometimes a crowd comes from another town, so there will be, you know, five or six kids laid out in the library, and they're everywhere. And I think it's much better than wondering where my kids are, so I get to know their friends. But it's busy, and it's loud, and it's expensive, and all that. But there came a time when every night they woke me up, and they would stay up late playing whatever, Magic or L5R, or playing video games, or just sitting up talking. And they woke me up every night, and I was getting really angry, and I would get up and go, "Can't you be quiet? That's so rude. People are trying to sleep." And then I realized I'm waking up at 3 o'clock whether they're there or not. And then I thought, oh, it's hot flashes, it's menopause. I'm waking up myself. But until I figured that out, I would go up there and I would yell at those boys. I'd shame them. I'd tell them they were awful and that they should just go to bed. Better not wake me up again. So, of course, they thought I was getting old and crazy, and guess what? They were right. So when I figured that out, I wake up and I think, hot flashes, And I get a magazine, and I turn on a fan for some noise, or I turn on a radio, and if I hear them, that's fine, and if I don't hear them, that's fine. And I quit being angry at them, but that was a danger for them. They were not safe, because when my biochemistry woke me up, they were in trouble, and that wasn't fair, and that wasn't right. So I'm there, in case any of you have anything to feel bad about, and you think I'm perfect. No, I was totally irrational, over and over. And it'll happen again, but I don't know about what yet. I talked to a dad just the other day. He lives in Grants, New Mexico, and he has a six-year-old named Jesus Apodaca, and they just took him out of school, kind of. Okay, this is what I thought. They just took Jesus out of school. He's not going to go to first grade. Grants is a kind of a little mining town, not a real old town, not a really pretty town, kind of funky little town. And his dad was named Aurelio, and I talked to him for a long time. He sounded really young. He sounded to be like a 25-year-old guy. And he said, Aurelio said, when he was in school, he cried every day until into the fourth grade. And he just wanted to be at home with his mom and dad. And there was no way. So his dad, same guy, still in the picture now, is shaming him and his son about Jesus not going to school. So I found out in the course of the discussion that school put him out last October. He said, well, at first they only had him come a half day. First it was half day kindergarten, they went to full day, but they would send Jesus home, because he couldn't handle it. So they treated him like he was too little for kindergarten, so he was already embarrassed, the other kids were being mean to him. And by October, they just asked his parents to take him home, and maybe wait a year. So the kid's in a situation to be failing kindergarten. And he said, the kid is just like me, he's going to be just like me, this is going to last till he's nine. And he said, and I'm so worried, because now he's behind. And I said, he's been home since October, he's ahead, because you don't have to undo all that. So we talked for a long time, and he said that the boy had been playing video games and computer games since he was three. Because I asked, you guys have the internet at the house? And he said, oh yeah, you know, he knows how to use that. And he said, but his father keeps saying, you know, the grandfather keeps telling him he won't learn anything and he won't have any friends. So I told him, you know, here, I grew up in a little town in northern New Mexico, and Grants is in western New Mexico, and I said, here's the threat. Here's how you mess with parents in New Mexico, as you say, you know, there are other towns, and I know how to get there. Because that family's lived there for a long time. And the threat of them taking their grandson away might shut his dad up. So I just bypassed all homeschooling information and just went straight for the, I know where Denver is, I got a car. So Jesus needs to be safe in his own home. And in this case, it's not, you know, he's safe from school now, but he's not safe from his grandfather. And so part of the job as a parent is to create a peaceful environment, even if you have to rough up your own mother to do it. And you cannot, when you're the parent of a child, you have the responsibility for that child. And you can't get out of the way and let your own relatives run over you and them too. And I know in some situations that's hard. And Northern New Mexico is one of those situations very often. If you live in a little town and you own your land and your houses in common with your family, that's hard. But if your priority is peace for your children, that will determine how you make some of those decisions.
Before we do the list, the voice in the back here. We're gonna ask for your help in this list. So I hope there's another mic maybe that can go around. Sandra, looks like there's one behind you, or there's one there. Okay. Sandra is very kind and generous about my international, whatever she's calling me, as a peacenik. I don't know how, maybe how she phrased it. Actually, though, I need to amend that a little bit. Actually, quite a lot, because to me the acts of peace or the acts of violence, as Thich Nhat Hanh teaches in his work, occur in our daily lives, in the daily routines of our daily lives. And for me, it's not so important that one comes to a clear understanding of a definition of peaceful parenting. What's far more important is that one engage in the practices, the small everyday practices. There will be times when the practices are much bigger. But for example, many years ago, when our 18-year-old daughter was, I think she was 3 or 4, and I don't remember even what I was doing that day. I was in graduate school. I know I had something to write or whatever, and she really needed to see me. And I took the time off to go out with a video camera and be with her while she pulled her wagon with her Bert and Ernie and other whatever else was in the wagon. And I still remember this to this day. It was a spontaneous, simple, I'm here with you, just being here with you, and taking these videos, you know, probably for the grandparents or something, I don't remember. And we didn't do anything that was big or special, or certainly not international. You know, the greatest gift that any parent can give a child is the gift of your true presence. There is nothing you can give your child, no curriculum, nothing material, no journeys in terms of traveling to places and so on, nothing that can possibly replace your true presence. And when I say your true presence, I mean really being there with your child when you're with your child. And even if you can't do that all the time, because that's tough, that is tough, being able to do it in small moments in ways that are really meaningful and profound, that's the practice. You know, I have a teacher in meditation who once told us in one of our sessions, she said, as you start to breathe, your mind will wander, because minds wander, she said. That's what I asked her. I said, why does my mind wander all the time? She said, because minds wander. Simple. And here's what she said to us. As your mind wanders, bring yourself back to your breath. And then she said this. She said, the quality of love and compassion you bring to bear in bringing yourself back to your breathing is your entire practice. That's your practice. And if you're able to do that and give love to yourself in that kind of meaningful way, then you will be in a position to help others. Then you'll be qualified and ready to help others. The practice is very simple in that regard. So I just want to be clear when we, you know, as we pursue this, that I don't think I hope nobody worries about getting this down intellectually, so to speak, you know, or missing the techniques and details. You have in you all you need to know and do to do the practice. And the question is simply becoming mindful and aware of the everyday moments in which you put that into practice. And this is very important, because are you going to screw up? Sure. And you become mindful of the moments when you screw up. And you become present for those moments. And you come back to yourself and you forgive yourself. And you do the best you can to move on. It's my friend's comment that when you're really in practice, right, what happens is right before you're about to mess up, you stop. So, does that help? I want to make sure that's out there. So, you want to orchestrate?
I don't think we need a mic out there.
We don't?
They call out words.
Yeah.
We just want single word synonyms, okay, for peace. Okay? Or peacefulness, either way.
Okay, harmony. I'm going to repeat it for the tape. Justice. Serenity. Love. Hang on. Patience. What was the other?
Respect.
Respect. Safety.
Safety.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Tranquility.
Tranquility.
Yeah, whatever.
Forgiving. Was it empathy?
I like calm.
Calm. Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
Embracing.
Embracing. Presence. What was the other? I'm sorry, I didn't hear something else.
I think that's it.
Settled.
Settled. Relaxed. That's almost like settled, but... Cooperation. Solitude. You need a mic. He's talking about the 10 plagues and Passover Seder. And now he's laughing.
Solitude, safety. I'm sorry. Regard. Okay.
Regard. Okay. Do you have compassion?
Compassion.
Do you have another color that you could put opposites up there with? Okay. What is not those things? Yes. What are the things you need to take away to have this?
Yeah, the threatening.
Discord.
Do I want to put them next to
me? Just a different color.
Okay. Sure. Discord. D-I-S.
You have to get used to this disorganization.
Huh?
Pardon me?
Oh.
Yeah.
D-I-S-C-O-R-D.
Down. The third column has room. We're not going to have as many opposites anyway, because.
Fear.
Fear. Abandonment. Tension. Evil. Anger. Hate. I want cynicism. It's little, but it can be horrible.
Right.
That's even better. Negativity covers that. Criticism. Competition and threat. Sarcasm. That goes with negativity and cynicism. Sarcasm. Coercion. Meanness. Okay, that's good. Okay, so you guys got the idea, right? So you have the potential for all those things in your house. Now, what do you do? I have a story about my sister, my poor sister. You know, and that's what she gets for being my sister. She used to call me almost every day. And she would just call and kind of complain. Her oldest kid was older than mine, so she should have known more, but she's younger, so she thought it was my job to hear her problems for the rest of my life. And I still do my duty. But she would call and she would say, I was so angry about this or that little stupid thing. And I'd say, okay, well, you could do this or that or the other. Okay, thanks, good idea. And the next day she would call and go, that's just it. I can't take it anymore because I was so angry and they were stupid things. And I said, you know what? Everything is the last straw for you. And she said, what do you mean? I said, it's like you have this big load of straw. And you take one straw off and then you feel better and you go along till one more little thing happens and that's the last straw. And I said, you need to spend some time unloading half of that straw. Because, you know, worse than my kids waking me up at 3 a.m. once menopause came, she was like that all the time. And she was 30. And she didn't have a good excuse. So if you don't have any peace in yourself, how are you going to allow your kids to have some? Because if you don't have any peace and you're angry and you're not sure why and you're just waiting to see what made you angry, then your kids are not safe. They won't have peace. So the first thing you do if there's a loss of cabin pressure is put the oxygen mask over your own face and then help your child. There's no sense shoving oxygen over his mouth and yelling, breathe, I said breathe, when you're the one who needs to be doing the breathing. So every time you have a choice,
a common example.
Every time you have a choice. You know when you have little kids and you don't say, what of all of the clothing that we own or that I could possibly buy at Walmart would you like to wear today? That's too big. But you say, you want this red shirt or this blue shirt? And the kid feels like he made a choice, and he makes that choice, and you gave him a choice, and he's starting to practice making choices because he could also say, neither, I want to wear that green shirt. Do that with yourself, too. You get pretty angry, your adrenaline's upon you, and you have about a half a second to decide what you're going to do, and the first two choices that come to your... Don't ever decide from one choice. You know, wait till you got two, and make the better choice. And if you think, okay, I'm either going to whack him or I'm going to yell at him. Yell at him. That was the best choice you had at that moment. And the next time, start with yell at him. Okay, I'm either going to do what I did the last time or something better. I'm going to yell at him, or I'm going to go in the other room for a second. Go in the other room. And the next time, maybe your choice could be I'm either going in the other room or I'm going to take a deep breath and make a joke out of it. Make a joke. And gradually and incrementally, you come closer to the place where you want to be. Because I don't think anybody can just jump from a lifetime of responses and expectations and behaviors and just pick some other person and just become that person. You can't do that. But it also does help to have other people around to model. Think, either hang around, really hang around with a family that you respect and see how they are with their kids and try to be more like that, or even in your imagination. You know, if you want to envision, depending how old you are, you know, you're going to be Ozzie and Harriet if you're really old, and, you know, or whatever nice TV family or literary family you want to be like. And pick one that you don't want to be like. That's a legitimate as all get out use for literature. Is have some good role models and some cartoons to be avoided. You do not want to treat your kid like a, you know, he's Oliver Twist. So Oliver Twist is your extreme at one end. That's not right. So get in your head some models and let that be your guide to be more like. Another way is to get witnesses. That's one reason people join support groups and confess to their friends what they're doing. Because you've told somebody what your intention is, you've told them what your problem is and what your intention is, and now you have witnesses. And for some people, that helps. Sometimes it needs to be an imaginary witness, sometimes it needs to be a real witness. But maybe if it will help you imagine that the friend that you most want to impress is there, and would you do it if they were there? And I know, because my mom was unreasonable, she would get drunk when I least expected it. Sometimes I would be sleeping in my bed and somebody would come wake me up to show me something wonderful. You know, not my dad. My dad was okay, but my mom was kind of crazy. She woke me up one time because after the bar closed, a bunch of them had come home and there were musicians there. And I really like musicians. I like music. But she woke me up because a guy from Santa Fe was at my house and wanted to play Orange Blossom Special. So I came out and heard Orange Blossom Special. And so that's not a big danger, but still, you know, the idea that drunks will wake me up any time of the day or night to show me something cool, while educational, was still not real peaceable. So it's just a matter of finding peace in yourself. And when you recognize it, when you know how to induce it, it's easier to help someone else find it and to maintain it. So don't hold on to straw if you can let it go. In your off time, unload some more. You know, try to figure out how you can be happier and calmer about things. And I've given away this comment to Richard. I have in my notes, it's not good to say, I will be happy when.
Okay. A couple of things here. Sandra has mentioned very accurately that you have to have peace in yourself. The question is, if you wait until you need for that peace to be there to ask the question, how do I achieve it? It's too late. Can I achieve it then? It's too late. It's too late at that point. In some of my seminars, I do work in Holocaust studies. And people would ask me, you know, given your views on nonviolence, how do you respond to the Warsaw ghetto fighters who fought to the death against their captors? And I said, don't think that they were under any illusion that they would either win or that they were fighting for peace. Who knows what they were thinking when they went into what they knowingly understood was probably a battle to the death for themselves as well. I said, but you know, it's a little late to ask the question at that point. By the time you've got the Warsaw Ghetto, it's too late. It's too late. And we so often operate, not always, but we so often operate in a reactive emergency mode. We wait until, you know, we wait until the car accident has occurred to begin asking, you know, well, what do we do now? Well, we should ask, what do we do now, long before you ever got in the car. We should really become mindful of our driving so that we're qualified to drive the car. That doesn't mean that accidents won't happen, because there are no guarantees in life, but they're less likely to happen if we are mindfully engaged in a practice of preventing them than if we are mindlessly in a realm of forgetfulness while we're driving. So what I would say is that part of peaceful parenting involves your engaging in a practice. What my teachers would tell you is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. One of my teachers said to us quite openly, if you are not committed to the practice 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I don't want you to study with me. Go find another teacher. Does that mean you won't mess up? No, of course you will. But your commitment is to do this all the time. That's the key. So how do you do that? Well, you take moments to look up at the blue sky and enjoy the blue sky and just breathe. You make sure that you have a practice of some kind of meditation practice, whether it's sitting meditation, walking meditation, eating meditation, driving meditation, whatever. If you don't have a practice that's consistent and regular that allows you to build up a reserve of peaceful seeds, as they will say in Buddhist psychology, then you won't have those seeds ready when you need them. And make no mistake, you'll need them. Thich Nhat Hanh says, we need to practice mindfulness all the time so that we plant healing, refreshing seeds in ourselves. Then when we need them, they will take care of us. An example that I use sometimes is, if you don't put money in the bank to save, when the time comes that you need money, you don't have any. If you don't put gas in the car, then it'll run out of gas and you won't have any gas left to run the car. You have to plant refreshing seeds in yourself. And you don't need any money to do this. You don't have to join any clubs to do this. Other than subscribing to Paths of Learning, you don't have to subscribe to anything else to do this. But seriously, it's in the way you eat your meals. It's in the way you drive your car. These are the ways you can just enjoy. Thich Nhat Hanh says to suffer is not enough. There also must be joy. You must find joy. Because what's going to happen is that when you get to those moments in which things come up in the family, and for homeschooling families, they probably come up, I don't know, maybe even in more intense ways in some sense, because the dynamic is there so closely all the time. If you're in the practice, I would respond a little differently from the way Sandra responded in terms of the anger. I will confess that I'm very influenced by Thich Nhat Hanh when it comes to dealing with anger. Thich Nhat Hanh says, when you're angry, don't say anything, don't do anything, because you will regret it. Don't say anything and don't do anything. In our family, what we've begun to do is to call time out. But we didn't start this process in the midst of the war. I'm going to exaggerate the language here. When everything was cool, everybody was getting along, everything was fine, you know those moments, right? Okay? We say, hey, you know what? Let's talk about when things go wrong, how we're going to handle it. Because everybody's feeling okay at that point. And we worked with a therapist to work this out, okay? And what we agreed to was that, like in athletics, we would call timeout. And the rule is this. Someone calls timeout, everybody stops. And we're very Kantian about this, Immanuel Kant, if you know his stuff. That is to say, of course, I'm going to follow that if you call timeout, because when I call timeout, I want you to follow it. When the whole system breaks down, I'll learn very quickly if I don't honor your timeout. Now, does that mean that everyone will stop right away immediately? Actually, we've got